Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Fearscape Media Network, exploring the unknown, one podcast at a time.
Hi, listeners.
Listen to the Books and Boosts podcast with me, host Anna Timperley, and
Marlena Lear, as we crack open a bottle, or two,
or three, and dive into some interesting books, airing the first Wednesday of every month. Bye!
Everybody to the Convergence Enigma with Josh and Stefan here on the UnX Network as well as the Fearscape Media Network. I am your host, Stefan Gehart, joined as always by the jolly and gullible co-host of mine, Mr. Josh Rutledge. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fantastic. Currently being yelled at by the Madar individuals because I thought a cloud could be a UFO. So.
Well, speaking of UFOs, we got a great guest here tonight. For those of you on YouTube, you guys can see we've got Earl Gray Anderson here. He's MUFON State Director of Southern California and an active member of MUFON's ERT, the Experiencer Resource Team. And it was great because Josh and I at the MUFON Symposium got to go to one of the Experiencer workshops, and it was absolutely fantastic. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. It was a good symposium, huh?
It was fun.
And yeah, we had the ERT table, you know, the Experiencer Resource Team is, I have been with them for about 4 years, maybe a little over that now. And it's kind of, you know, it's all high strangeness cases that we deal with, abductions, visitations, and I really found an affinity for that. So I was kind of working the table, but it was cool because Kathleen Martin was the table with me for a while, who, you know, is my dear friend and colleague, but I'm still a
fan. Been on the show
boy,
a couple times for us. Yeah, we are too.
Yeah. But yeah, just a lot of great folks rolled out for this one. You know, he had Mark D'Antonio did an excellent presentation.
One of my favorite the whole weekend.
Just in a good chance to meet him in person as well. So, hey, Earl, I have to ask. I'm sorry you probably get asked this all the time. Were your parents tea drinkers?
It's a musician name.
Okay.
Do you want the quick story? I'll give you the quick story. I'm a musician and singer-songwriter, and I kind of focused a lot of my energies at that for many years. You know, I'm here, grew up in L.A. I'm a native and almost famous, just like that movie almost, but I played in a lot of bands. We opened for a lot of, you know, good and interesting, wonderful people. But around 1989, I was playing a place in Santa Monica in particular called At My Place. And there was a guy there whose name was, let's see if I get it. It wasn't Eric Anderson. It was the, oh goodness. I, It wasn't Eric Anderson, but it was close, right?
Close, yeah.
And he was the guy who played Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar. Oh, he was a tall black guy who did R&B stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, what is so, his name?
So the guy that did the marquee screwed up. He switched our names, our nights. So I get there and there's his name up there, and I'm like, because it was really close, so the names were close, Anderson and stuff, and I was just kind of thinking, well, you know, I don't want that to happen again. And people would kind of, you know, refer to Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull and go, oh, so I get it, you know, it's a pseudonym, you're kind of Jethro Tull like. And so finally I'm trying to figure out what to do, and I was in a friend's, you know, cabinet, and I see Earl Grey tea sitting there, and I start laughing. And I realized, well, that's like free publicity. Anytime I play any mm-hmm. coffee house or anything like that, I'm already there.
Yeah.
And then they won't be messing my name up with the other Anderson guy. And so that was where Earl Anderson or Earl Grey came from. And but now, you know, I kind of stuck with it. My grandkids call me Earl Grey, so you know it's hot. Just how it is. It's just but it kind of works, you know, the gray alien thing.
Yeah. And, well, there's also the Picard reference, right?
Yes, the Picard thing, and I had that name. I picked that name before Star Trek: The Next Generation. Mm-hmm. So then, of course,
you
know, Star Trek: The Next Generation starts up. And it's Earl Grey hot. And I'm going, oh God, everybody's going to think
now you can be like, I'm Earl Grey. And
they're all going to think that's where I got it from.
And you were thinking of, Carl Anderson.
Yes. Carl Anderson.
I love the Jesus Christ Superstar movie. That's him. It's one of my favorites.
Very good. That was a quick Google, or else you had that.
I did.
In there,
no, I IMDb'd it, but I knew who he was because I, recently was looking up Ted Neely, and so I was like, oh, I wonder what the Judas guy, if he did anything else musically, because I'm a musical theater major. And so I was looking up, I was like, oh, he's done some R&B and some other music, and I started listening to his stuff on Spotify, and so I actually kind of got hip to his music a couple months back. So
he's really good.
What's
weird though, I mean, the thing is, I was doing like the acoustic, one man acoustic thing, and people were coming to see him expecting to hear a full R&B band with a horn section and everything. And what's weird is I played in a black gospel funk band before, you know, back in the late 1970s. And we opened up for Al Green Marvin Gaye, you know, at one point. And we played all kinds of places. But I never bumped into him in particular, but there I was, you know, the end of the 1980s, and I'm doing my acoustic thing, you know. You don't have to pay side musicians and stuff,
right?
And if you can do it, you know, and get away with it, and that's kind of was my forte at the time. But you know, all these people were coming out to hear some cool funky music, and I wasn't it. So I didn't want to repeat that again, you know. And I don't know, you know, it could have just as easily happened to him, you know, and
he would
have gotten a bunch of people out there that wanted to hear something more akin to like Richard Thompson or, you know, James Taylor or something in that realm. Nope, you got Judas from Jesus Christ Superstar. So, you know, and I was just ready for a change anyhow.
Yeah.
You know, it was just kind of, you know, but it stuck, and there you go. And people still like to call me Earl Grey. I kind of incorporated my actual last name, and I usually go by Earl Grey Anderson. And you know, when I publish my book, it'll have that. It'll be under Earl Grey Anderson, and that way it covers all the bases pretty much. You know, so there you go.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. So you're off doing your musician thing, right? You're you're jamming out, calling it unplugged, so you can charge twice as much, and decided to get into UFOs.
That's a whole other story. You want to hear my origin story?
Yeah,
yes, we do.
It goes way back.
Because you kept alluding to it at the workshop, but we didn't get the whole thing. So I was like, we're going to ask him.
I think I talked about that on Saturday. You guys were there on Sunday.
Yeah, we missed the Saturday one.
Yeah, that was a cool Sunday was great though. That was, you know, we got everybody's story, and that was what we were building up to as we opened up the, you know, giving the microphone to people in the audience who had alien contact. When I was a little kid, my mom told me some strange stuff. When I was about 5 years old, it was just, we were sitting in the kitchen and she started telling me about how, I mean, we knew that she had worked for Howard Hughes. She was one of Howard Hughes's two personal secretaries. She worked in the Santa Monica Sepulveda office there of Hughes Aircraft. And she was very good at, my mom was always really good at telling the truth, you know, telling if somebody was telling the truth. She was good at finding out, you know, somebody's veracity, you know, more or less. And I think that maybe made her, for some reason, Hughes had an affinity for my mom, and he kept like kicking her up in the ranks. But she was she was technically a stenographer. That was back when they did the shorthand stuff, which you can't read unless you take a class in shorthand. It's weird scribbles. Then she wrote everything. Her shopping lists would be in shorthand.
Wow.
But she would be the person that would go to these high powered it was a military industrial complex, the early form of that. My mom was kind of, she was it. And she had to have very high security clearances to do this. And she knew pretty much our great national secrets. So anyway, my mom, she sat me down in the kitchen and, you know, we all knew about that. That was not, you know, it was no mystery around that she had done that. And that was her job. She quit Hughes when she gave birth to me in 1958. Yes, 1958. I'm 64. I'm old dude. but anyway, I'll never forget this. My mom starts talking about, you know, there was this very strange place where I used to work, son. They took me out to the middle of nowhere, the middle of the Great American Desert, and I never found out which one. But now I'm starting to put some things together. But she said they took me out, and there was this little shack. It looked like nothing. It was just a concrete kind of bunker shack, and it was locked up and stuff. They opened it up, and there was an elevator in this thing, and I got in the elevator. I knew it wasn't going up, but, you know, I thought it maybe was going to go down a couple floors. She said it kept going down and I was getting butterflies in my stomach. I was scared. And the doors finally opened up and there was a little city under the desert there. She said that they got around in golf carts, that there was, you know, people lived down there for long periods of time. She seemed to know a lot of German rocket scientists. You know, I would, you know, Walt Disney would come on with, like, Wernher von Braun was one of the guys that Disney would feature back then. And my mom would say, that's my old friend Werner. He is a charming man. You know? And she said that they had a bowling alley. They had a barber shop, but the guy could do my hair for me. So apparently she got her hair permed in a military, a dumb, you know, a deep underground military base. And she talked about this a little bit. And then that was kind of the end of the conversation. And when you're 5 years old, it was just like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, but you don't really question stuff. It's your mom, right?
Yeah, right.
Later on, my mom would talk about life in the universe as though it was already a done deal, but we knew, you know, she spoke about it with authority. I overheard a conversation with her and her sister talking about the Betty and Barney Hill case. And, you know, my mom was saying, well, I think that this could very, very well be real from what I learned and what I know. And this was my mom's background. Back in 1977, she kind of gave me another disclosure number because my mom kept getting cancers over the years. And now I've heard, I've done a lot of research on deep underground bases. And this seems to be a common thing. A lot of people would get cancer after cancer. It wouldn't be a metastasized thing. It was just like they were irradiated. I don't know if they were using a nuclear pile down there to, you know, for power. I mean, it was probably off the grid.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise you'd be able to, where's all this energy going? And that's, you know, there goes your secret.
Right.
So 1955 or so, when she was doing all this, I figure that they probably didn't know how to protect people from this properly. And so she kept getting sick. So we went to see her oncologist in this movie called Star Wars had just come out the day before. So my mom had a clear bill of health and she was all happy. I was happy. I was maybe 19 years old at this point. I said, hey, there's this new movie. You know, it's early. Let's go have lunch and let's catch the matinee of this new, you know, science fiction thing. It looks really good. So after the film was over and the curtains closing, my mom just, it's like, son, you have no idea how close to the truth this is. You know, there's other life in the universe, the spaceships, all that. She said, they'll never tell the public this. They're afraid of how people will react to it, but we already know this is real. And she said, I never forgot this, but it put kind of a bug in my ear that I couldn't get out for years. She said, it's realer than you will ever know, son. And for some reason that just kind of ate at me. It was kind of like, well, I should know. Why is that realer than I should know? And,
right.
Over the years, you know, my mom kind of clammed up. She got back into the aerospace industry as a headhunter for a corporate headhunter for, you know, she peopled the old Rockwell Science Center out in Thousand Oaks area that built the space shuttle. Lockheed Skunk Works was one of her major contracts. Northrop was a major contract. Northrop, by the way, they have a deep underground base, or at least they used to. It had 20 floors, apparently, called the Ant Hill out in Tehachapi, California. Anyway, nobody arrest me, please. I don't think I never had to sign any NDAs on that. I think it's kind of in the ether and people know about that.
Any EG&G out there?
I know, exactly. Well, we had a guy in MUFON ZRT that used to work for those guys. But when my mom passed away, I mean, she passed away from, she got cancer over and over again. I mean, it kept coming back. And finally, the last time it got her, and it was 1999, she was on her deathbed. And I wanted her to lawyer up. I wanted her to expose what had happened, what they had done to her. And you know, I told her it's not right. They didn't compensate you that well. You know, she'd go to Europe every year. It was her big, you know, that was her big splurge, but it wasn't worth her life. And other than that, we kind of, it's not like we were rich or anything. Mm-hmm. So, but my mom said, I would never sue my government if I would do it again. She said, you know, it was me. This is how I served my government. I love my country and I would do it all over again, son. I would never sue them, you know. And she was gone maybe a week later. And I started, you know, I just really started reading through all the Leslie Keene's book had recently, you know, was one that had made an impression on me. You know, there were a few. They seemed to be getting a little bit more disclosure as time went on. And finally, I just realized that the only way I was really going to learn anything was if I got my own hands dirty and if I investigated it for myself. And that's when I joined MUFON and I became a field investigator. And I guess I was good at it. <You know? laughs> And now I'm like 800 and some cases in.
Wow.
And that doesn't include, you know, the cases that the experiencer cases through the, you know, the ERT. That's another at least probably 100, 200 or something there. So that's how I got here.
So have you ever had your own experience or?
It's funny you would ask that. Yes. Yes, I did.
Welcome to the show.
Well, you know, I mean, it's not unusual, right? I mean, what now, you know, about 7-8 years ago, I was kind of a novice and I heard about the CE5 thing. I was just starting to investigate cases. And I remember I closed one that was a Mylar balloon shaped like a star, right? And, you know, I'm looking at him going, I know that's a party balloon. It's a gold yeah. party balloon in the shape of a star. And so I was kind of feeling my oats, you know, I had my IFO, you know, and I can't wait until I get a UFO here, you know. But I remember going upstairs and, well, if you poke at the phenomena, it's going to poke back. I mean, this is something that I've told for a long time. Yep. I kept my own story to myself, but I would tell my field investigators because I felt like I owed them that little caveat, that little heads up, you know.
Yep.
And I would tell them that, you know, it's kind of a, it's not like you're going to be a scientist with a microscope and there's something separate from you that's on some microscope slide that you're investigating. Mm-hmm. This thing is all around you. And it's I think it's part of us. You know, it's I think that there's some kind of integral thing between us and our visitors. It's not just, you know, air shows in the sky. If something's mm-hmm. going on, I think it has to do with humanity, with evolution. So just be aware. And then I would tell them what I'm going to tell you, that I went upstairs that night after closing the case with a gold balloon, my IFO. And I was lying down. I usually put a bunch of pillows behind my back. So I'm sort of semi-recumbent when I go to sleep. My wife was already asleep next to me. And this is in Burbank, California. It wasn't a rural place. It's the middle of, you know, bustling Burbank. Mm-hmm. So I was not asleep. I was kind of getting ready, getting comfortable, and the room starts filling with light. It was just kind of gradual, but you couldn't not notice it. There was no source for it. Wasn't coming from a light bulb. It wasn't coming from outside. It was almost as it was light without a source. And the brighter it got and the deeper, thicker it got, it seemed like it was thick, like it was this substance, like a liquid almost. I became more and I couldn't move eventually. I mean, it paralyzed me. Mm-hmm. But I felt strangely calm. I mean, we had a cricket problem in the rafters. You couldn't hear crickets. Sounded like somebody had coated our house in cotton. You couldn't hear external sounds. No road, wow. You know, traffic noise or anything like that. The walls started doing this weird swirling number. and it looked like somebody had poured cream in a cup of coffee. It just, the wall just did this and opened up. And it was maybe 7 feet across, like this opening.
Yeah.
And you could see light coming from behind it. And these four diminutive entities came through. They didn't come through the wall. They came through the opening in the wall. Right. They didn't walk up to me. It was as though they were drawn to me somehow. It was the weirdest thing. And I couldn't move at this point. I'm trying to communicate with them, as you know, I figured, you know, it was, well, I was trying to make contact. I guess this is it. I guess it's not going to be Valiant Thor,
yeah,
some pretty space girl or something. It's these guys. And well, they were not communicative with me. They seemed to work together like a surgical team. Everybody had a job to do. And I was inside, I was screaming. They started taking blood from me and it felt like energy, like life force as well. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if they were going to stop. I wasn't getting a calming message. I mean, I'd read some of Bud Hopkins' books where people were told, don't worry, you know, this will be over. We're not going to harm you.
Right.
Nothing like that. There was no communication to speak of. It was just, scared the hell out of me. Anyway, they finished doing what they were doing and they left. It was maybe 15-20 minutes maximum. It didn't take them long to get what they wanted. they didn't exsanguinate me. You know, I was still alive, you know, although I felt very weak for a couple of days. They went backwards, back through the wall. The wall shut up. And I still couldn't move for a while. The room was still lit up for a while, but it slowly got dimmer and darker. And when I could move, I started screaming and yelling, shaking my wife and yelling about aliens incoherently, more or less. And I think that she was really angry. I think that she may have thought that I had had a mental breakdown, or I don't know what she thought, but she hadn't had any of this experience herself. And, you know, she said something to the effect of, oh, my God, you've joined this crazy UFO group. Is this what I have to look forward to?
And, yep, I hear it.
You know,
yep, same.
Now, I just kind of curled up into a, you know, fetal position and just molded over. And I didn't sleep anymore that night, of course. It was like 3 a.m. when it, you know, it was over. And we didn't talk about it. I talked to my state director about it. He was kind of a nuts and bolts guy, so he didn't want to hear, you know, oh, my great. My new field investigator says he met aliens.
Right.
Crap. Put all that time into training him, and here we go. I called Peter Robbins, and he was a little more understanding. But, I mean, it's just weird, you know? I mean, you know, somebody decides to become a field investigator. You know, you don't generally, you know, suddenly have a close encounter, you know, of the fourth kind.
Right.
Well, two nights later, my wife is shaking me awake. And again, our room was flooded. It was flooded with light. And my wife was pacing. And she was like doing this and she was pacing. And she said, my God, Earl, you need to tell your little friends they need to leave us the F alone. She used used that word. I already have insomnia and I don't need this. And what the hell, you know, and she's just and two nights after that, we both woke up and again, our room was flooded with light. We call it the weird week. We call it our weird week. and the third night there was light though, that was coming from the window as well. And we both went to the window and we were looking out there and it was coming from above the house. Yeah. I was not going to go outside to see what it looked like. You know, I didn't want to meet those guys again. So I, you know, now looking back at this, it changed me as a person, knowing where I am now, knowing my mom's past that she had in involved with this stuff. And I've learned more because, you know, she does apparently have a file, you know, with the Pentagon, you know, and I've had a couple of interesting people read bits. I probably shouldn't mention their names, but you probably know one of them. They're you know, kind of mucky mucks that don't hide that they, you know, have, you know, government contracts and stuff. And so I've found now, you know, that if there's a connection in somebody's, it's familial. If there's a connection in the parent's life or the grandparent's life, that seems like people, you know, the children and the children's children, that there is very, very often, more often than not, there's ET contact that happens. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why. I've heard that perhaps it's because they're familiar with that bloodline. They recognize it. But you know, it must be something more than that than just familiarity. Well, but I don't know what.
I mean, in you know, if you subscribe to the theory that, you know, that we are experiments in a lab to the ETs, right? That they're monitoring us to see how we react or respond to various stimuli, then it would make sense that they would track through those genetic bloodlines, right, to see if whatever they did 40 years ago has had an effect on, you know, the down the line generations. I mean, we do the same thing, right? We experiment on mice and other things. So
it is a laboratory, normal laboratory technique, you know, if you're,
well, I gotta say, so it's really interesting, and I hate to share my own story during your own time, but
no, I don't hear it.
So I experience night hag syndrome, have since I was a kid. You know, all kinds of stuff, the sleep paralysis, the hags, the dark figures. And one of the stories sounds eerily similar to what you had just shared, because I was staying the night at my friend, my best friend Santosh's house. And the way this room was set up, the bed slides right in. I mean, it fit in between the two walls. You know what I mean? And anyways, I had woken up and I couldn't move. And I saw two figures there as usual on the side of the bed. And they were grabbing me and trying to pull me and things like that. And I can't move. I can't scream. I can't do anything. And one of them steps forward to the wall at the end of the bed and wipes it like that into a circle. And this portal opens up.
Wow.
On the wall. And they step through the portal and grab my leg and proceed to pull me through the portal.
Oh, no.
And I'm awake, right? So I'm freaking out, and I'm trying everything in me to scream because I don't want to go through this portal. I don't. And I got to be 28, 29 years old. I mean, this is not like 5 years old or anything like that. I'm a full ass adult. So, like,
wow.
But I'm trying, and I'm like, I took every ounce of me. I'm like just about up to my thighs, and I was able to muster, and I screamed my best friend's name, and he comes busting through the door because the room was two bedrooms were adjoined. So he literally hopped off his bed and ran through the door, and it woke me all the way up, and my legs are pressed up against the wall, and I'm sitting with my legs pressed up against the wall, and he's like, "What the hell are you doing?" And I was like, "Dude," and I'm fully awake at this point, and I told him everything that had just happened. But I mean, I can remember that. Looking at him and then looking and seeing my legs pressed up against the wall. But just you talking about how the wall opened up and everything like that, how you used the cream. That's how it felt to me, was like a latte. If you were to swirl it, that's kind of what it looked like to me.
Maybe that was more than just sleep paralysis.
I know. That's what I'm wondering now. I need to add it because I'm an experiencer. Because there is
sleep paralysis.
Yeah.
People will see, you know, usually tall, you know, robed figures and things like that. But, well, in my case, I was not asleep, though. It wasn't like I woke up out of sleep. I was awake. I was hoping to fall asleep.
Right.
that's I got something else. You know,
but I've always, that makes me wonder, because I am an experiencer myself, and I'm like, is that another one now? Because
maybe it like triggers the other, maybe they kind of trigger each other, you know.
Maybe it
felt to me like you know, as I got calmer and as the room kind of flooded with light, I felt like I was put in more of like a hypnagogic state, because I was calm. I mean, I wasn't. It took a while for me to be horrified. I mean, when I started thinking that this could be fatal, that was when that's when I got scared. And you know, here's the thing, though. You know, I think that our visitors, they run the gamut as far as their motives go. Humanity runs the gamut, right?
100%.
Just because there's bad humans, it doesn't mean that they're all bad humans. Yep. And just because there's good humans doesn't mean they're all good. And we're not talking about gods or angels. We're talking about other beings like ourselves that are just more highly technologically developed than we are. It seems like magic to us, but this would look like magic if I handed it to Leonardo da Vinci. It's just, you know, high technology that he wouldn't understand. So it would be witchcraft, and I would get burnt at the stake or something.
Right.
You know? But I don't think it was magic. I think that it was a technology that's higher than ours. And I don't think that they were just trying to scare me for the halibut, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, but as time went on, you know, I had a couple of other experiences. Like, I had a close encounter with a craft. Again, I was driving to work, and I saw this craft, and it wasn't a beautiful UFO. I mean, I always wanted to see, you know, this, you know, just like a sleek looking, you know, zero gravity,
the sports
flying
model.
Saucer. And exactly. Yeah. I have a model I made of it up there, but you know, it looked like somebody had taken these shipping containers, like really huge ones and very heavy ones, and had welded them together into the shape of this kind of like a boxy V. But the closer I got to it, the more I could tell that I really wasn't in control of myself. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, while that was happening, I didn't realize it. But when I finally got away from the thing, you know, I was just like, you know, what happened to me there? But, you know, I was me going to work. I obviously, you know, wasn't smoking anything or that you're drinking. Right. And not like you see something like that if you drink too much anyway. But the closer I got to it, it seemed like it was a teachable moment. You could, you know, I'm like trying to figure out how somebody hoaxed this thing. First of all, is my field investigator training coming in, and there was nothing that you could tether this from. There was no telephone poles, and it was like 35 feet off the ground, hovering over the schoolyard. When I was about 35 feet away from it, it suddenly changed in perspective. It was a mile away, and it looked like it was the size of a football field. Same shape, same, but it just wasn't there anymore. It got, and that, you know, and but, you know, I wasn't taking photographs. I wasn't calling the media. I wasn't, you know, calling other star team members for MUFON. Though what was going through my head was, and I didn't like my job that I had at the time. What was going through my head was you're going to lose your job. You're going to be late for work. You'd be like, you know, it's like, who cares? You know, this is a UFO. Oh, it's a smoking gun. But, you know, I mean, they were in control. I wasn't. I'm like 3 miles out. And then I'm like, I pulled over. I'm ready to fire myself from MUFON. It's like some chief investigator I am. You know, I could have had the smoking gun. It would be, you know, all over as far as, you know, them withholding this from the public. But I think it was to teach me something, that what you see isn't necessarily what you're seeing. Other people aren't necessarily going to see it. For you, and it was a teachable moment about something, about perspective.
You know, that's something that Stefan and I talk about a lot, is that in one of the theories that I have even is that to see a phenomenon, whether it be a full craft, whether it be a being, whether it be, you know, lights in the sky, whatever, that you just can't explain, that event for you, the viewer, is an initiation for you, the viewer, right?
Yes.
It is meant to change something, to change your perspective, to cause you to think outside of the box.
Yes.
And then when you don't, so a little bit of a, so Stefan and I had an experience in May of 2020, and then I haven't had one since. And I've wanted one. I've wanted them all. Like every night I go out looking at the store. I want an experience, you know.
Yeah.
But,
I hear that. But
I've not had one. And so, you know, the theory that I have and or that, you know, whatever I'm developing is that they appear when you need that change in perspective. But if you're already going down the appropriate path from the first event, there's no reason for them to show themselves to you again. It's only if you start to sway or deviate from the path that they think you should be on to have that, you spoke of, kind of next spiritual evolution as a species. That's when they reveal themselves to you again to kind of get you again, get those creative juices flowing and thinking about what does this mean and what is, you know, what does this mean for us as a people? So anyway, so that's just one of, like I said,
you're right. I see it that way too. I mean, you have a person will have that flash point. Okay. Or that catalyst where that's that initial experience and it like opens up the whole Pandora's box for you, you know? And for me, you know, John Mack would call it ontological shock. And what that is it, you know, that's what I experienced with my initial experience, was it felt like reality, my formed reality of a whole lifetime's worth of living on this planet was pulled out from under me like a rug, sort of like a magician pulling the tablecloth out from under the dishes, you know?
Right.
There I was, you know, I'm still me, but everything is changed and in a way, you know, I kind of suffered from PTSD from it, and I you know, I met, you know, one Marine guy that was taken through the ceiling and stuff of his barracks and went through a horrifying, you know, I mean, they were intentionally trying to scare that man. But it changed him too. You know, I'm talking with him 40 years later and just kind of a compassionate, empathic man without a mean bone in his body. I think that if, you know, if there are certain Shaolin monks that will hit you with a sword to wake you up, they'll hit you with a blunt end, but they'll hit you hard, right. You know, and it's just like, wake up, you know? And I think that that was my wake up. It initiated synchronicities in my life. I started experiencing things would connect. I understood the phenomena suddenly much more than I did before. Things started making sense. I started connecting dots about stuff. And I would be thinking of a certain author or wishing that I would meet some, you know, oh, I wish there was another witness that I could call on that had seen the same, you know, craft and stuff. Well, that would start happening, you know. I mean, they were, you know, synchronicities, which Carl Jung came up with that word. It means a meaningful coincidence. And that's one of the gifts that experiencers are given. Kevin Day experiences this. He experienced this after he had his close encounter with the Tic Tac on the Princeton. He had like gifts that appeared in his life that we would normally attribute to our visitors themselves. So I think that there's like a cosmic contagion. It's a good contagion. You want to catch it, you know, where it actually makes us better humans. You know, it may be a scary, horrifying experience. You know, that may be what it takes to shock us. And you know, I don't think that my beings necessarily had good motives. I mean, they seem pretty malign, but I don't think that they're in charge. I think that they have to, all the beings have to answer to whoever is in charge there. I think there's something like Star Trek's prime directive or something.
It's funny because I don't know, about, we'll call it 45 days after Stephanie and I had our experience in my backyard. I'm like off the deep end. I'm reading as much as I can get my hands on. I'm researching stuff. I'm reading. And so I'm laying in bed one night and I imagine whatever, but I feel like I'm having this telepathic conversation with Ingrid Cold. And so, I asked Ingrid Cold about the Greys, and he says, we needed them, so we made them. They're like biological androids. They do our bidding. And then I've heard other people describe the Greys, you know, in documentaries and things, as kind of being the same. So it's, to your point, synchronistic in a way, because it's kind of giving somewhat of a significant, you know, whatever the, I can't think of the word right now, what I want to say, but it's, giving it more value because if somebody outside of my immediate circle is validating this experience that I had. And that's one of the things that you know, has driven us to do this show for almost 3 years since I got involved, is that kind of echoing of, you know, what people are not alone. And there are people that have these experiences every single day all over the globe. And, you know, the number of people who report it to MUFON it's probably a small drop in the ocean of people who experience these things that just go and never report it and never tell anybody and just carry it throughout their life. And so, you know, that's probably the thing that as humanity, we have the most in common, is that we all experience these bits of the phenomena. Yes. And we all have that in common.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, it's a personal phenomena, you know. I mean, this is one thing that I've seen with experiencers, whether they believe they're space brothers or they believe that they're evil reptile people, whatever.
Right.
It doesn't matter. It seems like it makes people better people. Their empathy is kicked up. A lot of people will become telepathic. They'll have psychic flashes. They'll get downloads, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know, in the book of Acts or something in the New Testament, you know, it's, yeah. There's like gifts that,
yeah.
that people have. And I see it from case to case to case. There's even a term for it, the Vallée Davis effect, they call it. Kenneth Ring noticed this at first. He wrote a book, what was it called? The Omega Project, I think it was, that he wrote back in 1991, where he was a guy who studied near-death experiences. And he would started noticing that there were similarities between the people that had a near-death experience and the people that had had a face-to-face with our visitors, with the entities. And so he wrote a book about it. And Vallée and Eric Davis also noticed this in all of their studies from case to case to case. So people know about this, but you don't hear about it. I don't think you hear about it enough. I think there's a lot of people running around that are horrified. I know people that wish they could kill their aliens or throttle them. You know, there was one guy that, you know, was sleeping with a gun. He was hoping that they wouldn't quite, you know, paralyze him and you'd be able to shoot him. You know, it's like, don't, you'll shoot your neighbor, you know, or you'll start an interstellar war. Not a good idea, dude. But I think that it's not all malign. Now that may not be the motive of that particular entity, but the overall thing is that contagion is that we get that from them. And you know what else? Nothing is ever just one way. I think that we're affecting our visitors too. I think that we're possibly humanizing them because they're spending a lot of time with us. And from what I'm seeing, there's like this exchange of, you know, energy or whatever it is that, if they're changing us, I'm sure we're changing them too. So, so this is kind of the way I look at the phenomenon now. It's really changed, you know, from the nuts and bolts idea that I had of it. You know, I thought I was going to be looking for spaceships, you know?
Yeah.
And in a way I am, you know, but, the exciting thing is seeing this interaction. And I think that it has to do with human evolution, you know, because here we are, you know, we're still, hating on each other. We're still a warlike species. Our technology is way up here. We're ready to enter the space age, but yet, you know, we're acting like a band of ruffians, you know, Genghis Khan, you know, eat your heart out.
Right.
And so something has to change with humanity. And I think that that's what's going on. I hope they work faster.
You know? Right.
Well, you know, thinking along that line too, is that Stefan and I have talked about it before. If Hollywood in the movies and the shows and things have been a catalyst of, you know, desensitization of the human race to ET, right? And it seems like, I was just mentioning this today, it seems like a lot of the new movies and shows are dealing a lot more with spirituality, not necessarily religion, but just spirituality in nature. And so if you accept the, you know, the idea that they have been along the way for the last 60 years helping us to accept ET, is this the new kind of narration of, you know, the narrative of, you know, kept getting us to accept more of spirituality and where that can take us as a species?
I think that there's something deep that's going on. I don't think it's malign. I don't think they're demons, you know. That was a big problem that the Pentagon had. You know, they threw $22 million into this study that you know, kind of centralized around Skinwalker Ranch and all that. And a lot of the guys and you know, the mucky mucks in the Pentagon, they felt like, well, no, this is from the devil, you know. And they didn't want to touch it. They didn't want any more money to go into that, any more funding, and they didn't even want to hear what we learned because, you know, they misconstrued it. You know, we were just kind of very, you know, we have our little box of comfort that we like to think in, and anything else we call, you know, paranormal, we call, you know, and it just like the word paranormal, you know, MUFON doesn't like that word so much because actually, what we need to do is open up our idea of what normal is.
Right.
It's not para, you know, it's part of normalcy. Extra, you know, I mean, you know, Newtonian physics is so quaint. you know, we've lived with a Schrodinger's cat for many, many years now, but people are still comfortable with their, you know, kind of nuts and bolts, you know, apple falling out of a tree hits the ground, bam, and that's all there is to gravity. And of course, we know that it's much, much different than that. It's closer to magical realism than that.
For sure.
So anyhow, I what I love about this phenomenon and just where it's taken me is it's felt like a journey. It sometimes feels like, you know, like there are epiphanies that, you know, it'll be kind of quiet and I'll learn some stuff. And then all of a sudden, boom, you know, it's just, oh, that's, wow. And the synchronicities keep coming, you know.
Yep.
I mean, I had a case that I was working on 7 years ago. And it was back then I thought it was an amazing case. It's like, oh my God, this is like a Blue Book case. We're better, you know, and involves this whole family. And then the main witness passed away. Lo and behold, a little less than a week ago, I'm reading, you know, and just some random UFO group on social media. And it's like, wait, this is that same case. Wait, the guy died. Well, it turns out that it's the guy's brother and he's ready to talk now. Back then he didn't want to talk, you know. So, you know, we lost the main witness and now there's two that actually want to talk. And I'm so thrilled, but it's a deep case. You know what I mean? It has like a UFO crash involved with it. Mm. It was on parts of it were on the front page of my old local newspaper. This happened in my old hometown.
Wow.
You know, Thousand Oaks, California. And one of the people involved, one of the witnesses I've known since high school, you know, and that person is ready to talk now. Before, she was not ready to talk. It was like, no, it's just too distressing. It gives me PTSD just to even think about. So, you know, it's kind of like these things will come to you in the right time. And it all seems very strangely ordered. I wouldn't have been ready for this case 7 years ago. I didn't understand the intricacies of this strange, strange phenomenon. And not to say that I can understand it now, but I certainly understand more than I did then. And I've got, you know, so many cases to compare things with. And you notice markers, things in common with everybody that has experienced this. There's stuff that I don't tell the public about that, you know, somebody will say the same thing. It's just like, bing, you know, a little bell ring, you know. And it's just an extraordinary thing. I don't feel like I'm alone for some reason. I feel like there's some guiding force.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the way that, you know, it's interesting you use the word journey, because Stephan and I have talked about, you know, since we saw our sighting in my backyard, we feel like we've kind of been on this spiritual journey and these things are kind of unlocking along the way. And it seems to be that it unlocks when we need it to unlock, not necessarily when we want it to, right? You know, like I said, I'm like, give it to me now. But, you know, it's like it knows that I'm not quite ready to realize that truth, and so it kind of holds back a little bit. You know, so I mean, I had that experience that night. We've had a few things here and there. I saw a black triangle taking my kids somewhere one day, little things like that, but
I've never seen one of those, and I'd loved, I mean, you know, the only black triangle I've ever seen is this one. You know, as my little, you know, visual aid for TV and stuff, do you think that we build those, or do you think that those are a product of our visitors,
both?
Or do you have an opinion?
So I think it's both.
Yeah,
I think I think there are some that we build.
Column A, Column B.
Yeah.
And I agree. And I think the ones that we build are probably our best attempt at replicating the ones from our other, you know, counterparts. So
I think they look similar on the outside. Yeah. I had one cop that saw one, and he was maybe 35 feet away from it, and it was just hanging there. It was hanging over his neighbor's house, but it didn't look like his neighbors weren't being abducted or anything. It looked like somebody was on a coffee break or had to take a restroom break or something and just left it in park. And he's looking at it and he could see these indentations, and there was like ventilation systems that he could see. It looked like, and looked like there were hydraulics in there, and that doesn't sound like a UFO to me. Now if we saw one of their black triangles, I'm sure that it would be much you wouldn't see all the plumbing and stuff there. You don't really see that on UFOs. But
mine, the one I saw, kind of was just above the tree line, just kind of sailing across into nothingness. And I was driving my kids to go get COVID tested so they could go to school that day, and so I couldn't pull over. I couldn't take pictures. And I'm driving, you know, and of course my wife's looking at her phone, and my kids are half asleep in the back seat, and so I'm the only one that saw it. But again, you know, to the idea of these things are presented to you to kind of keep you engaged or keep you kind of moving in that direction. And when I look at that part of my life, I was kind of questioning, what am I doing? Is this still like where I need to be? Am I crazy? You know, so on and so forth. And so here's this kind of, you know, nope, you're not crazy. This is stuff that's really happening.
synchronicity again. My wife's high school buddy, she and her husband met us at the Denver Symposium for dinner, and she brought her husband along with her, and Lisa didn't know where he worked or anything. And we're all talking our usual stuff, and there are a few ufologists sitting there, and we're talking about black triangles and all this stuff, and he looks kind of, you know, he didn't want to talk. Well, we found out this guy works for Lockheed Skunk Works, and he works at Plant 42 over here, you know, where I got hauled away with a film crew, you know, because the security didn't like us dealing with a camera pointed at there. I mean, we were following the signage and everything, but they still chased us away. And he works at the Point Magoo facility. And I have a friend that lives in the flight path that would be Point Magoo to Edwards area. And he's seen some weird stuff. I mean, he saw a black disc with one little red light in front, perfectly silent, going right across, heading towards Point Magoo, you know, where Lockheed is. And he called his wife out and his drummer. He has another musician guy. That's my friend Eric, recording studio out there on his ranch. I know so many people that have seen stuff in that area, also near Plant 42. I've had aerospace engineers put in UFO reports, and the one guy, and I know he wasn't, you know, pulling my leg. I'll ask to see the badge and have them redact numbers and stuff.
Yeah.
But I want to see the badge and know. Yeah, he was an aerospace engineer. Plant 42, he's saying, I just want to know how to get on that project. Do you know how to get on the project? I said, my mom might have been able to help you, but I don't know, you know.
Well,
now I had a triangle that was seen in 1965, and I don't believe that was ours. And it was seen by a whole family. I got them all and, you know, interviewed them all separately. I'm in their like early 90s now. And that was not us. That was 1965. Yeah. I don't think we had anything.
Well, you know, and this will probably be a conversation for if you want to come on again. We got to start wrapping up.
Sure.
But I'd love
how quick an hour went.
Yeah, goodness. It always does.
Pick your brain more about the secret space program. But again, next time.
Sure. I'm sure we have one. Of course we have a secret space program.
So
where your black budget dollars go, folks.
Right, black triangle budget.
I want one, you know.
Yeah.
But we wanted to give you an opportunity. If there's anything you wanted to plug or talk about, this is that moment that you could kind of share anything there.
Thank you. Well, if anything that I've been saying sounds familiar to you guys out there in radio podcast land, just go to MUFON, M-U-F-O-N, MUFON.com. That's our main website, and it'll say report a craft sighting or report an abduction entity or visitation. And if you click on either of those, you'll get somebody like me or one of my teammates that I have in my group, and we'll investigate your case. If you're an experiencer, we will treat that with kid gloves. You will be safe with us. We're non-judgmental, and we treat contact cases very differently. And we'll have resources if you feel like you need a support group. You want to have a hypnotherapist to try to regain missing time events and stuff. So MUFON is all purpose, big tent, and I love the organization. So I highly recommend that you would do that.
Perfect.
And that's perfect. Kind of it.
Thank you. Thank you, Earl Gray Anderson. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you guys
so much for tuning in to the Convergence Enigma with Josh and Stefan. This has been Stefan, and I just want to remind you to keep your eyes on the skies.
This has been Josh. The truth is now.
And remember, folks, keep questioning, keep searching. Good night, everybody.
Good night.